Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have an interview with LQ Gurley. LQ was the 1990 NPC Nationals overall winner, and then LQ went on to win the world championships in the light heavyweight class right after that competition. And then he spent several years as a professional in the ISPB. He placed really well in his very first pro show, the Ironman Pro, where he took third place, which was a very good placing for a rookie competition in the pros. So we're going to talk to LQ about his career and about his decision to stop competing and where the sport went after he quit competing. So we got a really good interview coming up with LQ Gurley in a minute. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right, and we had a great interview last week with Len Kinnear, 1986 Mr. America winner, and also Larry Bernstein, who won the short class at the Mr. America in 1983. As I mentioned before, I grew up in Chicago, and I got to watch Glenn and Larry, and I kind of looked up to both these guys. They were about 4 years older than me. And I saw Glenn actually when he was a teenager. When I was, I think, 15, he was like 19. And he actually trained at the gym I trained at, Delt's Gym, and then that turned into Hammer's Gym. So I really admired Glenn growing up, and it was great to see him progress all the way up until winning the Mr. America contest in 1986. And Larry was another great guy, and Larry also had a lot of success in the sport, winning the Mr. World and the Mr. America in the short class in 1983. Larry was a very thick bodybuilder. So it was a lot of fun talking to those guys for the last 2 weeks. I hope you guys enjoyed those interviews. I got some good news. We got some good interviews coming up. I did an interview with Tom Terwilliger, Phil Williams, and Jerry Branham, and we took the advice of one of the people who emailed me, and we did a session together with all four of us, and we talked about who looked the best in all the mandatory poses of all the bodybuilders from the golden age, which is the 70s and 80s. So we had a really long discussion, and that'll be a two-part episode. So that'll be coming up in the next few weeks. So that was a lot of fun talking to all three of those guys. I love all those guys. They're great guests. And I also had an interview with Danny Padilla, the Giant Killer. So that will be coming up next week. And I know you guys have been looking forward to that as much as I was. And I've been trying to get Danny for a long time, and I just reached out to him again, and he said, yeah, let's do it. So we got it done last week. So I was very happy to do that. So we will have part one of our interview with the great Danny Padilla next week. So make sure you guys join us for that. All right. At the end of our interview with LQ Gurley today, I'm going to read a couple articles because these are both short articles. They're both from Iron Man magazine. And it kind of relates to what we talked about with Glenn and Larry last week. The first one is from the November 1981 issue of Iron Man, and this is about the 1981 Mr. America, the Tim Belknap one. We talked a lot about that in our interview with Glenn and Larry. The other one is from the March 1982 issue of Iron Man, and Jesse Gautreau is on the cover. And this article is about how I saw the Mr. Olympia and the top six men and it's written by Stephen Robinson. So that, of course, was the very controversial 1981 Mr. Olympia that Franco won. So that is also kind of a shorter article, and they're not real too long, so I'm going to read both of them when we get done with our interview with Al Q. Gurley. All right, and let's see. We got some emails from last week's show. I didn't get any direct emails, which is to my email at naturalolympia@gmail.com, but I did get, I think, a couple of comments on my Facebook, and I also got some comments on my YouTube page, so I'll read all those in a second. On my Facebook page, my friend Gino Lafredo said, this guy was such a beast. And Brad Allen said, I'm loving this two-parter. I'm in as much awe as Larry at John's unbelievable wealth of bodybuilding history knowledge, and I'm really enjoying listening to you guys. I admired as a teen in the magazines. I'm just getting to the Tim Belknap part. I'm kind of excited to drive to work tomorrow and catch that part. Richard Bronger said, great interview. Thanks, John, for all you do for our sport of bodybuilding. I had the privilege to train at Glenn's gym in Phoenix. Very impressive physique. I met Larry at a show in Tucson, Arizona. He complimented me and was a great guy. Thanks for sharing this. And Richard Bronger also said, John, any way to get Marlon Darton on the podcast? He lives in Phoenix, Arizona also. I'm sure he has some good stories. Actually, I did contact Marlon this last weekend, and he did get back to me, but we never really kind of finished our conversation, so he kind of dropped off. So I'll try him again, but it sounds like he's interested because he did contact me back. My friend Gino Lafredo, who left a message here, unfortunately, is in bad shape. I just found out yesterday he is in the hospital, and he's on a ventilator or something with a staph infection, and it attacked his body. So, man, I hope he pulls out of it. Gino's an old friend of mine from way back, the 1980s, 1990s. I actually trained with him when I won the 1996 Natural Mr. Universe. Big guy, great guy. So I'm hoping Gino pulls out of it. He's married now, lives in Chicago. He has a couple of young kids. So I just thought of that when I saw his name there. All right. Anyways, let's go to our comments on the YouTube page. And this was part two of our interview with Glenn and Larry. Mike said, I saw Lance guest pose in 85. I was 16. I could still picture him arriving in the room in a t-shirt with arms that were unreal. Yeah, Lance did have unbelievable arms. You had to really see him in person. When I saw him as a teenager, I was blown away too. Jerry said, this was really good stuff. Belknap looked amazing in that clip from 84. Wow, Larry looked great too. Belknap was ready for the Olympia stage. Kim said, I love the guys laughing and joking and humble. Andrew says, I love the plain, honest speaking. Great interview. Dean Phillips said, I agree with Larry. John's knowledge of bodybuilding is incredible. His love and passion for bodybuilding is top-notch. Rich B said, awesomeness. Brought back so many memories. I actually had the privilege to train at Glenn's gym, Hoppy's. He was very courteous and respectful to me. I met Larry at a show in Tucson, and he complimented my physique. Thanks, John, for sharing this. Traveling Bo said, these guys are awesome, drinking a brew while talking bodybuilding. The Spritz said, John, great idea would be interview Lance Dreher. He has lots to say on bodybuilding. Actually, I did interview Lance already a couple years ago. If you go to the bodybuildinglegendshow.com website and look under podcast, you'll be able to see that. It was, had to be about 3 years ago, I think. Let's see. Jim Broderick said, this is awesome having these legends on. Barefoot 132 said, thanks for the interview. Inspirations back in the day. Stay healthy, gentlemen. Kim said, John, you're great. You know everything. Amazing. Thank you, Kim. Rohit said, the pics and the videos in between the conversation bring color and life and reality to your interviews. Great. Dark Solara said, fantastic as always. Hell, I wish I was closer. I would grab a beer and sit down next to you guys. Dean Phillips said, the best of the best. Great interview. Reinhardt said, great show. Mac and Ash said, good one, John. Thanks, mate. I love listening to these Legends podcasts while I work out. It's so inspiring. Dan Smith said, another ripper. Philip said, great stuff. And Gwen Roberts said, awesome viewing. All right. So those were the emails I got. And as I said, I also have the videos on my YouTube page, so you could check that out as well. And I did add a lot of old pictures that I got from my old magazine. So if you get a chance to check out the Glenn Kinnear, Larry Bernstein part two interview, check that out, because I got some great, great old shots in there of Glenn and Larry when they were younger. And also got some great shots of Tim Belknap and Lance Dreher in there too. So check that out. All right, that's all I got for our opening. Here, without further ado, is our interview with Al Q. Gurley, the 1990 MPC Nationals overall champion. Here we go.
All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. I have a very special guest with me today, Mr. Al Q. Gurley, who was the 1990 MPC Nationals overall winner, and he also won the World Championships that year, and then he spent several years as a professional bodybuilder. Welcome to the show, Al Q.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
All right. So we always start at the beginning, LQ. So you were born in Philadelphia, is that correct?
Actually born in Massachusetts, and I grew up in Philadelphia.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. So what got you into bodybuilding?
Wow. Going back to the beginning, it actually started with track in high school.
Okay.
And a friend of mine who I happened to work out with in high school suggested that, you know, this is something you should do, man. Increase your body strength because it'll help you overall.
Yeah.
So during lunch period, we would like go to the gym and work out, get our sessions in and whatnot. And I learned from that. And then it benefited me during track, and then it just held on afterwards.
Okay. Now, weight training really wasn't that popular back then, right? For athletes back in the 70s, probably?
Well, I'm in the 80s. I graduated in high school in 1980, but it was just starting to come about because at that time, you're talking about the Pumping Iron video with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw that in 76, and it's like, wow, look at this.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of inspired and encouraged everything. And there were some guys in Philadelphia who were working out at the local level and the regional level.
Mm-hmm.
And in the local gyms, neighborhood gyms, and started hanging out in there and just looking at it. And pretty soon, guys were like, yo, man, you got a pretty decent physique. You should come in and train.
Okay. So that's when you started going to the gyms then after high school?
Yeah.
Okay. So what got you involved with bodybuilding? Did you see somebody at the gym or did you read magazines or something? Well, you saw the Pumping Iron also.
Well, it was a combination of things. You had the guys in the gym, the local gyms, and then there were guys who were competing at the local level, the Mr. Philadelphia and the regional shows.
Okay.
And at that point, it was myself, my training partner at the time, Anton Mays, and Horace Jackson.
Okay.
These guys who basically laid the foundation and the seed work for me getting into the competitive realm.
Okay. What did you do after high school? Did you go to college or?
I went to Howard University. I was there for 2 years. And then after that, it was just a number of things I got into.
Okay. So when did you do your first contest out here?
1985, I believe it was. And that was a show over in New Jersey.
Okay. What was the name of that show? Do you remember?
Wow. I do not. I mean, going back that far, a lot of this stuff is a blur.
Right.
And, I won that show, and I did another show in Pennsylvania. It was a regional, national level show.
Okay.
I came in second in that one, and everybody's like, hey, maybe you got some.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I was like, oh, I don't know, because I was just doing it to stay in shape and get in condition. And then I met my coach, Richard Brown, the guy who basically gave me the foundation and the groundwork to go forward with it.
Yeah.
And he was very encouraging and had a lot of inroads into the MPC as well as at that time, the AAU.
Yeah.
And you had, you know, competitors in the Philadelphia area like Richie Beretta.
Yeah. Mr. America.
Ron Hester. And in 1987, that was the first time I was exposed to the MPC Nationals.
Okay.
Went to Atlantic City and saw Vince Taylor, Sean Ray, J.J. Marsh, Troy Zuccolato was in that one. Wow. Phil Hill.
Okay, yeah, right.
So at that point, you know, the bug hit. You're like, wow, look at these guys. This is incredible. Right. This is tremendous. I think I want to do this too. And at that point, that's when I really started getting into the magazines and reading everything and just trying to, you know, take in as much as I could to find out what the industry and the sport was about.
Okay.
And then having that exposure to, like I said, Sean Ray, Vince Taylor. I got to know Vince prior to him winning the 88 Nationals.
Okay.
When Sean won 87, Vince won 88.
Right.
I think Franco Santoriello, Choi Zuccolato was 89.
Right.
And then
you were 90.
I came along in 1990.
Okay.
So I had a pretty good exposure. And at that point, prior to me winning the Nationals, I had only competed in 6 shows.
Wow. Okay.
So I was basically a work in progress. I always considered myself to be a work in progress because I didn't have that much experience and that much competitive time in.
Okay.
So it was always a lot of time spent in the gym and working out, trying to grow the package, refine the package, and just, you know, get to the point where I was up to speed with the current crop of guys. Because
yeah,
I had come out in a very competitive era.
Yeah, for sure.
So the '90s was incredible.
When you started training, did you notice you had good genetics? Did you grow pretty quickly?
No, I was a hard gainer. I was a hard gainer and a late bloomer. I mean, I was a naturally slim guy. I was a track athlete,
right?
Intermediate hurdles and a sprint guy. So I was a speed guy. So I was smallish in stature and frame. So
yeah,
me putting on size to be competitive at that level was again a lot of work, and it remained. I mean, we all are, but it remained a serious work in progress to keep up and maintain pace with that group of guys.
Okay.
You're talking about Lex Wheeler, Kevin Levine, a deep field.
Oh, Dorian. Yeah, for sure. So after you saw that 87 Nationals, that's what gave you the fire to say, this is what I want to do, this is what I can do.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was it. The following year, 88, having some experience with Vince Taylor and meeting him.
Yeah.
It just snowballed from that point on.
How did you meet Vince? Was he in that area? Was he living in that area?
Vince was in Maryland at the time, and mm-hmm. he had my coach and trainer, Richard Brown, had made some contact with him, and
okay.
he was talking with him at the time. And because I was the new guy coming up, I was always around.
Yeah.
So I made it a point to be around and see everybody, meet everybody. And got a chance to train with Vince a couple times. And at that point, I started to say, okay, I know what I got to do.
Yeah.
And Vince was at that time, he was the national champion. He's like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, one of the most impressive bodybuilders, not just of that era, but of all time.
Absolutely. I agree. Yeah. So what did Vince, did he give you any advice? Did you learn anything from training with him?
No. Not really. I mean, I think back at that time, I always called it the CIA versus the Kremlin, because everybody had the state secrets,
Right.
This is before social media.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the magazines were the main source of information and getting to know people and seeing them. So everybody pretty much had their, all their bag of tricks under their hat, and they kept everything close to the vest.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you got a chance to really meet people and then, break bread with them, hang out, then you got more of a kind of peek behind the curtain, so to speak. And, you got a chance to see what they did and how they did it.
Yeah.
But prior to really getting to know people on a personal one-on-one basis, not really.
Okay. All right. So you did your first Nationals in 89, and you did really, really good. You got second to Franco Santoriello, who was a great bodybuilder in the late heavyweight class. So what was that experience like doing your first Nationals?
A lot of fun. As a matter of fact, it took place in Miami at the Fountain Room, one of the greatest shows of all time, as far as I'm concerned, because not because I was in it was my first show, but the way it was presented.
And
it was in a great location, the Fountain Blue Hotel in Miami. So you had the backdrop of Miami, the beach.
Yeah.
And it, again, a circumstance and a setting that just really made a strong impression.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I said, my first group was 87 in Atlantic City. The second one was 88 with Vince Taylor in Atlanta. So 89 was Miami. So you think, wow, we're like progressively going up in all these like high end places and great theaters and
where
they were had their settings. And then finally, when I got to my show in 1990, it was at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles. Like, wow.
That was cool when they would move it around every year like that. You never knew where it was going to be. Even like the Junior Nationals, the USA, that would always be moving around, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now it's like the same location every year, you know?
Yeah, it tends to be in Miami now, but even the location that it's at is not...
No, it's not the Fountain Blue.
It's not as prominent, right, and it doesn't have the same grandeur and impact that it did. I mean, the Fountain Blue, and like I said, the show in Atlanta, Shrine Auditorium, that made an impression.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you really had the sense and you really had the feeling of like, this is the big time. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me about the competition that you're now. I got that right? That was your first Nationals in 89? Because you just went and saw, you saw 88 and, or 87, 88, but 89 was the first one you competed. Okay.
Right. Everybody kind of got on me because, you know, you should do the Junior USA, Junior Nationals. And my mindset has always been, and this is no knock against anybody who does it incrementally.
Right.
Like, let's jump into the deep end of the pool. Let's see where we stand. Let's see how we stack up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I just went into the 89 Nationals and went in against, again, deep field. You had Porter Cottrell, Franco Santoriello, Fletch Wheeler, I believe Daryl Stafford was in there. I mean, all the names from that era and all the guys from that era who became prominent at the pro level, you can see how competitive it was.
Yeah. What did you think of Franco, the guy who won the class?
I was pretty impressed with him because at the time, you know, he was the name. And,
big name.
He was seasoned. He was thick, heavily muscled and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And at that time, like I said, I was still a work in progress. I always saw myself as being kind of, you know, thin.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole mindset and my whole agenda was to bulk up, get thicker, get bigger so that I could compete with these guys because, you know, I'm 5'9" and a half, 5'10". So I had a longer frame. I had more to fill on.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys who were like Sean was like 5'7", 5'6", 5'7", whatever. And they were shorter and it made a difference as far as how you looked on stage and how much muscle you needed to carry to be competitive.
Yeah, yeah.
The guys like, you know, who are the heavyweight class, like Phil Hill, Detroit Lottos, and, you know, that group of cats, wow, I got work to do.
Yeah, right. So what was the feedback after you got second? Because that had to be pretty a great debut at the Nationals. And you beat a lot, like you said, you beat a lot of great guys.
The guy who really gave me the impetus to go forward and really, you know, stick with it was Lonnie Tepper.
Okay.
Lonnie Tepper did not know me. I came out of the blue. Like, who is this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And John Balick in Iron Man magazine printed a couple of black and white shots of me. And that's what really lit the fuse. And they say, well, who is this guy? He's like, came out of nowhere. He's got really polished, seasoned looking muscle.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to pick him as the 1990 front runner. You know, I came in second, but against all the names and everybody who was out there, I got selected as the front runner. And that was the impetus to really, you know, take advantage of everything. So you got to, you know, strike while the irons are hot.
Yeah. 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 And like you said, that was the era of the magazines and they would always, you know, they would always highlight the guys that were coming up and every year at the Nationals, there'd be favorites, you know, like this guy's going to, and Lonnie would do his predictions every year for the Nationals in the USA.
Right. So,
you know, yeah.
And he gave me a tremendous platform and a springboard to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people, you know, were telling me, oh, man, I don't know how you're going to do this one because, you know, you're not really known. You're not a name. Even people in Philly, you're supposed to be behind me.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know, man. The funny thing is, with all the naysayers and everybody who was very skeptical, it didn't matter because mm-hmm. I looked at it as I was there. I was in the big time and I had earned my spot. And a lot of people, including Vince Taylor, was giving me a pat on the back, say, yo, man, you're it. It's up to you to, you know, carry the torch and keep it going.
Yeah.
The funny thing at that time at the Nationals, the light heavyweight class was really the premier class.
Yeah, absolutely.
The class of the shows. Even though the heavyweight always got their just due, it was the light heavyweight class that was really the class of the show.
Well, yeah, if you look at the last 2 years, right? Vince won, Sean won, you know, so it was always coming to light heavyweights, yeah. So going into 1990 now, we did a couple episodes about this 1990 because that was the year they drug tested everything. They drug tested the Arnold Classic. They drug tested the Olympia. And then they drug tested all the big national shows like the Nationals USA and the North America. Now, how did you get ready for that knowing that it was going to be drug tested?
That really, the fact that it was going to be drug tested really changed the preparation because looking at all the previous Nationals, I knew how everybody prepared.
Right.
And this was, for all intents and purposes, a one-off because it was the first and only Nationals that was ever
done. Yeah, the only time they did it, yeah.
So, in all honesty, you basically had to clear out. You had to clean out, clear out.
Yeah.
So to test clean, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
It was difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
To the point, my preparation was to be as big as I could possibly be. I wanted to be at the top of the class.
Right.
Literally 198 on the nose.
Right.
I had gone up to like 230 something in the off season.
Mm-hmm.
So I literally had to lose like 34 pounds.
Wow.
To come in slightly under where we had targeted.
Yeah.
Because preparation with drug testing is dramatically different than the preparation of being on.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Let's be honest and let's be real. It is a completely different type of preparation. And because it was the first time, I came through it and went through it pretty well, but it was a beatdown.
Yeah.
It was a physical beatdown to get prepped and ready and be quote unquote clean for the show.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I came in looking drawn and not as full as I could have been.
Yeah. What did you weigh, Elku?
I came in, I weighed in at like 197, 198.
Oh, okay.
And by the time I had carved up, after the weigh-in, I went up to like 206.
Oh, okay.
But it wasn't, it did not have the same look.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was my concern.
Yeah, yeah.
But I evidently.
You knew about it all year, right? They announced it at the beginning of the year. So you had all year to just kind of prepare for it.
We had time to prepare for it. But the thing that stays in your mind, especially back then, 85, 86, 87, 88, 89,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all those guys look great. When I go back to 85, I'm going back to Lee Labrada.
Yeah, Phil Williams.
And Phil Williams, right. And all those guys look great.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you have, you know, and this is not making any excuses or anything, but then you have the drug test of year 1990.
Mm-hmm.
It's a completely different look.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Every class.
Yeah.
From the bantamweight, the lightweight, the middleweight, the light heavy, the heavy. We all look stringy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one thing it took me a long time to get over that. And
yeah.
I think I got labeled as being, you know, stringy or skinny or what have you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and rightfully so because it just
wasn't the same look.
Completely different type of preparation, and a completely different look.
Yeah.
Even if we go to the Olympia.
Oh yeah, totally different.
Downsized, and they look drawn.
Oh yeah, yeah. They decided never to do it again because the way the guys looked, you know.
Exactly, and then they said, "No, because that doesn't sell."
No.
It's good for the PR.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as they say, you know, freaks put butts in seats.
Yeah, exactly.
everybody wanted to see the freak show. Everybody wanted to see the guys who were big, and you know, and to see it watered down, diluted the way it was. I remember looking out into the audience, and I said, "Damn, the audience looks better than we do." Said, here we are on stage, and they look better than we do.
They were bigger than us.
Exactly, they were blowing up. They were blowing us out the box.
Right. Wow, that's crazy. When you saw Sean Ray fail the Arnold that year, were you worried at all? You know that about passing the test? No. Okay.
No. The fact that he had this, there's so much hypocrisy in that.
Mm-hmm.
Because with testing, be it at the Olympia or in the Olympics,
yeah,
all about levels,
right?
They test for levels.
Yeah,
if you exceed a certain percentage or a certain range, and mm-hmm. you're not in the parameters, then you're quote unquote you're busted, you're popped,
right?
And when you look to the left and you look to the right, you mean to tell me these guys are clean?
Right, right.
It's like no,
yeah.
So. You had to eliminate that because it just got to the point where I'm like, this is ridiculous. And because the hypocrisy of it, everybody on this stage fails.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
right.
Let's be honest. Let's be real.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if these guys are clean, then I'm Santa Claus.
Yeah. How did they test you guys? Was it urine test?
It was urine test, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the other reason why they decided not to go through with it again is because there's really no foolproof way to test, you know? I mean, it's just...
Well, there is, but you can't afford it. It's a blood test.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
No.
There's no way they can afford to test everybody. No way.
No,
they'll never bring it back. Especially amateur show.
Right, exactly.
So then you did the World Championship that year also, and you won your class there, and that got you a pro card, right?
I got the pro card off the national win.
Oh, just off the national? Okay.
The World Games win it. And so, yeah, the funny thing about the 1990 was the first year that the universe became the World Games.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, so it was, I'm like, wow, I felt like I was cheating because I was like, I want Mr. Universe title.
Right, right.
That's the one. The national championship was great, but to have the universe title would have been like, you know,
right.
The cherry on top.
Right, right. Where was that held that year?
Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Wow. How was that?
Absolutely spectacular, fantastic show.
Wow, no kidding.
They went all out. It was great. They even had government officials were there at the show.
Wow.
The trophies, everything, top notch, top drawer, first class, beautifully done.
Wow, no kidding. That's awesome.
And it was at the Pan Pacific Hotel.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
At that time, they had just started building the Petronas Towers.
Oh, yeah, one of the tallest buildings, yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
Great, great, great experience.
Wow, that's awesome. How was your competition at that show?
45 countries.
Wow.
From the United States, we had Khalil El-Amin, Joe Dawson, myself and Jerry Rogers.
Okay.
And
how'd the other guys do?
And Patrick Lynn. I believe Jerry came in second to Occam Albrecht.
Okay.
I'm not sure what Joe Dawson did. I'm not sure if Joe won or came in second. I think Patrick Lynn came in second as the middleweight, and Khalil El-Amin, I think he came in second as well.
Okay. So you were the only one to win then, huh? From America.
Yeah, I won my class, and we won as a team as far as team presentation, because over, you know, at that time you also had to compete as a country as a team.
Mm-hmm.
So we won the team competition.
Okay. Yeah, right, right. I remember that we used to do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So then now you're the new pro. And you go to the Ironman the next year. You did really good. That was your first pro show, right? You got third place.
Came in third, right behind Vince Taylor and Robbie Robinson.
Wow, that's great. What a great debut.
At that point, yeah, you're like, okay, I belong.
Yeah.
I'm competing against a top national champion and a legendary pro.
Right, yeah.
And, was very well received by Robbie. Vince, And again, everything because of their preparation, you being so dialed in to what's going on, everything is a blur. Everything is a blur.
Yeah.
But again, the overall, my first experience with the Iron Man, again, great show, great presentation, quality setup.
Yeah, that was a great show, wasn't it? The lighting was amazing at that show.
Absolutely, absolutely. John Bailick and I forget the number one photographer for Iron Man right now.
Michael Nevue.
Michael Nevue, right. Michael's great. Mike always was, really cool with Mike. He always would give me tips and pointers. And he used to tell me, he said, if you want to really make it in this business, he said, get to know photographers.
Yeah.
And I made that a point. I always got to know the photographers and hung out with them and whatnot. Robert Reeve. Everybody's name is slipping my mind right now,
but I just
made a point to really hang out with them and made myself available as many photo sessions as I could back then.
Yeah. So when you turned pro, LQ, what was your, did you have a game plan on what you wanted to do? Did you, you know, were you thinking about, I want to win the Olympia or I just want to do pro shows and have a career? What was your overall strategy?
Honestly, I never really looked at winning the Olympia because, again, when truth be told, at that point, it was kind of like an appointment, a political thing. The guys who had, were Olympia winners were like in with Joe Weider. And being at that time, you know, this is prior to contracts and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody thinks of, you know, bodybuilding. Oh, you get a contract when you turn pro. It's like, that wasn't the case.
Right.
So you literally had to earn your stripes. You had to pay your dues. You had to get in there and be somebody who was notable. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I was still up and coming, still in my mind, having to put on size and mass and really make myself comparable to the current crop of guys.
Yeah.
Because you figure at that time, you still got the Bob Parises, the Lee Haneys.
Yeah.
All the iconic names. This is the field.
Right.
It's like no way in the world. Like, oh, I'm going to win the Olympia.
Yeah.
You're in a long line because at those shows, you had about 9, 10, 11, 12 deep as far as, you know, all the quality competitors. And back then, it wasn't always about size. It was about finish.
How,
you know, did you have the shrink wrap shredded skin? You know, was your Christmas tree intact?
Yeah.
You know, the musculature in the back, the abdominal region. Did you have your intercostals and serratus? All of the finish was of concern and was concern and precedence.
Yeah.
So you spend the entire year working on everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to ask you about that because every decade in bodybuilding, it seems like the standards change, you know, and we got to a certain point probably in the 1990s where it turned and then it was all about size, you know, like when Dorian started winning, you know, 93, 94, and then it was like everybody was big and then the judges were rewarding that. But before that, it seemed like it wasn't just about size. It was bodybuilding. It was symmetry. It was shape. It was posing. And
right.
That's the era you grew up in, you know, back in the 80s. That's what was celebrated. So that's what you always thought of, right, as a real true bodybuilder was all of that stuff together. Yeah.
Absolutely. Lee Haney was the forerunner of size.
Yeah.
Because that's when, you know, when Lee Haney was going out, Dorian was coming in.
Right.
And you had the Momo Benazizas. You had guys who were, you know, may have been smallish in stature, but they were big.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is when, this is prior to Ronnie getting huge.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I remember when Ronnie and I were the same size.
Yeah. He was in 1990, right? Wasn't he competing in 1990?
He came, I think Ronnie came a little bit later.
Okay.
But he came in and he was more of a shape and symmetry guy.
Right. Yeah. Small waist, wide shoulders. Yeah.
And the point in where everything changed was like 94, 95, 96. 1986.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it just took off from that point on.
Yeah.
You had to make a decision. Or are you going to be, you know, size up? Because everybody started telling me, he's like, yo, man, you could be a lot bigger. You could be bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest I ever got in the offseason was like 250.
Wow. Okay.
And then I came down to compete at around 230.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Which is big.
Yeah, for sure.
But still, just think, you come in 225, 230, and you're still giving up 30, 40 pounds to people.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And you start to wonder, you're like, wait a minute. I'm not trying to get much bigger than this because it's out of control. I had people tell, oh, man, we can get you up to 270 in the off season.
Jeez.
Don't worry. I'm like, no, I am worried. I'm like, no, I'm not trying to do that. So at that point, I made a decision to just be, you know, I'll take a page out of Muhammad Ali's book. He said, I'm just going to be pretty.
Yeah.
Now, I'll just be pretty. I'm going to maintain the aesthetics and a certain symmetry.
Right, right.
Put on a little more size. And by, you know, 97, before my injury, I was very sized up.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the pictures, when I look at the Arnold Classic, when I did it in 97 before the injury, yeah.
Yeah.
At that point, I'm comparable. I'm on the level of a Kevin Leverone in size and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I had closed the gap.
Okay. Okay. What's your favorite look? I mean, what's your viewpoint? I mean, we all get into bodybuilding. We all want to look a certain way. And you started off, you know, like with the more symmetrical look, and then you were forced to get bigger. What was your favorite look? Was it the more symmetrical look, or was it when you got really big?
I like the aesthetic, clean, balanced look. I like symmetry and proportion.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a few conversations with Lee Labrada, and Lee used to tell me, he said, the name of the game is to look good from every angle.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how you're standing, no matter how you position yourself, you want to look good from every angle. You want to look like you want to look good from every angle, and you want to look like a statue.
Yeah, exactly.
And at that point, that's when I really, I used to cheat. When I was in the lineup, I used to look at Lee Labrada. Always look at how he was standing, how he positioned himself. And even when he was back in the lineup, he wasn't in a call out. He was posing.
Yeah, he was hard as a rock.
He was always posed. He was always, I'll just say it was beautiful.
This is art.
And it was artistic.
Yeah.
And I always followed that example. So, you know, even though some of the guys like the Sean Rays, the Vince Taylors, Kevin Leverones, we tried to play the size game for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then we all, you know, everybody just came to realize that I'm going to be who I am and play to my strengths. Because to try to jump in the bandwagon and be like a Ronnie Coleman, like a Dorian Yates or Paul DeLette, these guys who are just huge, just like...
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm taking myself out of play because I'm playing that game, and that's not how I'm built.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting now. I mean, it's so many years later. Now we're in, you know, 2021. But, like, if they go over Ronnie's career, I remember somebody asked Ronnie, they said, what was your favorite look out of all the Olympias you won, all the eight Olympias? He said it was his first one.
The first one. He was
smaller. Yeah, he was like 247 or something, you know.
Right. When he beat Flex Wheeler and – arguably, everybody thought that Flex had the more refined, the quote-unquote prettier package.
Right.
But being at that show and witnessing it, I watched Ronnie get better as the show went on.
Yeah.
And Flex did start to fade a little.
Mm-hmm.
But at that show, Ronnie displayed shape, size, symmetry, deep cuts, quality, refined muscle.
Yeah.
And it was impressive.
Right, right.
It was impressive. I thought that was his best look. Maybe a year or so after that, because there's a famous black and white back shot of him,
mm-hmm.
with the rear double bicep, which, as far as I'm concerned, that is the greatest back shot ever.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Anyone. It is the most visually impressive rear muscular bicep shot. I'm like, this doesn't even look real.
I know. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I know.
Everything.
I know him and I know what he looks like. And I'm like, yeah, that's him.
Yeah.
Like, it's impressive.
Yeah.
And I think that's where he looked his best. And if everything after that was just size for the sake of size to be, you know, quote unquote, more remarkable. And how high can we go? You know, how high can we push this thing? It's like Nasser El-Khelaifi.
Right.
He just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where we took ourselves out of play as an industry.
Prior
to them, everybody getting supersized, we were on Flex Magazine Workout.
Mm-hmm.
We were on NBC Sports.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, when we walked through the airport, people knew who we were.
Right.
Which was impressive because now we're becoming mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people say, I saw you on Flex Magazine Workout this morning. You know, that was great, man. You guys are so, you know, it was literally people were following the airport. I'm signing order. I'm like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
I'm signing autographs in the airport and whatnot.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, this is before selfies and all that stuff. People are still taking pictures, but this is before cell phones.
Right.
So you can see the impact that it had, but we took ourselves out of play, which was unfortunate.
Yeah. Even like if you look at Flex, everybody says Flex's greatest shape was his first Arnold win, where he weighed like, I think, 214 or 217. He got much bigger, too. But everybody says that was the best look, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, my Olympia, when I was my second Olympia in Atlanta, I was 219.
Okay.
And I love that look.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah.
And they kept saying, this is nice, but it's not enough.
Right. I know. It's a shame. Because, you know, we talk about the old days on this podcast. And I remember Frank Zane, when he won his second Olympia, actually went down 3 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
He lost 3 pounds because he looked at the pictures for his first win. He said, I could be harder. I could be more ripped. So the next year, he wasn't worried about getting bigger like they do now. He actually came down. And Lee Haney did the same thing. I think Lee Haney was 2 or 3 pounds lighter in 85 than he was in 84. So it's like those guys back then were going for the most perfect look instead of just see how much size they could pack on. You know?
It was called what they called the shrink wrap shredded.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, when we would make a back shot, you know, could you show a Christmas tree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, could you show the lumbar? Could you show every facet of back musculature?
Right.
You know, the back had to be as good as the front. The thing that we used to always talk about was, okay, you look good from the front. Turn around.
Mm-hmm.
As we used to always turn around, let's see what you look like from the back.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's when you started hearing about, you know, shredded glutes and stuff like that, because it was more refinement.
Right.
How detailed and how refined. Like, Samir Banu has one of the most famous Christmas tree back shots.
Yeah.
We have Renel Jeanvier, who started to show not just the detail in the back, but now he was showing when you did the when you planted the rear leg, you had the detailed glutes.
Right, striated glutes. Yeah,
striated glutes. Everything just really started to come to the point where, okay, how detailed can you get? And then you had the Andreas Munzers, who were just incredibly, you know, wow.
Yeah.
Does anybody get harder than that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think was responsible for that change, LQ? Do you think it was the judges' preference? Do you think it was the drugs? Why do you think the sport made that turn into the, you know, to the massive super monsters?
Because I think it went back to its cult origins. I mean, to become mainstream, now you're incorporating a whole new audience and a whole new power structure. Because you remember when Vince McMahon came into the bodybuilding realm, so he came up with a competitive league.
Yeah.
A completely different league. And like I said, back then you had the NBCs, the ABCs, the ESPNs were starting to pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. So who's looking at you now? Sports agents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, real sports agents.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I met a few.
Oh, really? No kidding.
And, I mean, these guys who were thinking about representing you because they're starting to see that this thing is going mainstream. And what athletes out there are better built than professional bodybuilders?
Yeah, nobody.
None of them. None of them. And they all started to emulate what bodybuilders were doing, how we were training, what we would eat. The bodybuilding lifestyle really started to become prominent.
And
once you, quote unquote, not that Joe Weider was going to relinquish or surrender the reins, because he had a death grip on the industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only way to keep it, quote unquote, in house was to take it back to its cult status.
Yeah.
And when you turn these guys into mass monsters and freaks, only a certain segment of the population is going to turn on to it.
Yeah, right, right.
The rest of it, everybody starts to look at it like, nah, I don't want to look like that. You look like a Frankenstein project. Somebody said, oh, you're a walking, I forget, what is the term they use?
A science project?
Exactly. You're a walking science project, man. Right. You know, come on. I mean, I remember one of the sportscasters in Philadelphia, one of the top sportscasters in Philadelphia, Al Meltzer. And he was talking about, you know, when baseball players started getting big.
Yeah.
He said, wow, these guys must have steroids in their orange juice. This is out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And when he made that statement, you know, everybody started looking at bodybuilding and say, all you guys are on drugs.
Yeah.
Even though everybody knew it, it was one of those things that was unspoken and you didn't talk. But then it came to the forefront and became prominent. Like, oh, you guys are on drugs, man.
Yeah.
You're not all that.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like the general public now just looks at bodybuilding as a freak show. I don't think they give it any respect at all, you know.
They get no respect because the general public is a lot more aware and a lot more educated, a lot more versed now than they were back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Yeah, when Pumping Iron came out, people didn't know about steroids. They thought those guys looked like that just because they worked out, you know.
They worked out, right. You eat a dozen eggs and, you know, eat two times a day and blah, 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 blah. You take all these supplements, you'll look like that.
Right.
It just got to the point where once the genie was out of the bottle, the public opinion went against us.
That's a shame.
To maintain that aura, that level, you have to go back to your core audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At that point, they literally gave up all that they had. The bodybuilding industry gave up all the gains that they had made. Lost NBC, ABC.
ESPN.
You lost ESPN.
Yeah.
Think about it. ESPN knows everything.
Right.
And we lost our spot on ESPN, and that was devastating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you took away not just Flex Magazine workout, but all the workout shows and the competitions that aired, you literally took the legs out from bodybuilding.
Yeah. Because what do you think is different also, too, about, you know, you came from the magazine era when everything was in the magazines, and compared to today's era with social media and the magazines are pretty much gone?
The magazines had more of a sense of legitimacy because it was, quote unquote, journalism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have the advent of social media and self-promotion, and you can do your own thing and put yourself out there. You can validate yourself.
Yeah, right. You don't need the magazine.
All you need is followers.
Right, right.
And if you've got followers, then you become an influencer, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All these new terms and all these new things that have propped up because of this media platform, which, you know, it has its advantages and it has its pluses and whatnot, but in the same light, I'm a dinosaur. I'm an old school guy. So I look at it, and some of them I just scoff at because I'm like, this is just, you know, shameless self-promotion versus, you know, qualitatively looking at and breaking it down and having journalistic people write about it and critique you.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I
critique you. They either accept you or they don't.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned journalism because I got a lot of the old magazines and I go back and read them. And man, they really, like you said, they really covered every contest in detail. And you really got a sense of what happened at that show. We're missing that now because the magazines are gone. So nobody's covering it like that. Nobody's. So you look at history, and I love bodybuilding history. I think that's very important.
So when you look at that, I mean, what are they going to look at over the last 5 years? I mean, these shows are just come and gone. It's like they're shown live now on, you know, live stream. And as soon as it's over, it's forgotten, you know, and that the people start looking at next year. It's like, wow, we're back when we had the magazines. They would write about it for months, and there would be, you know, Peter McGough and these guys would write in-depth details of all these contests, you know.
Great guy. Peter McGough used to always sit down with him at the Weeder compound.
Mm-hmm.
I had many a conversation with Peter.
Yeah.
Great guy to talk to, and gave me a very interesting perspective on everything.
Yeah.
So I would go into shows a lot more prepared because I spoke with Peter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Really scout competition, presentation, again, history.
Yeah.
How are you going to know where you're going if you don't know where you came from?
I know.
All those things matter. And because we live in the instant era now, with streaming, live streaming, like you said, once it's over, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And how many people really keep track of photographs and stuff like that?
Yeah, right. Sean Ray made that point in an interview I saw. He said all those great photos he's got a history of his career, and that's gone too, you know?
It's gone. Again, if you don't have a visual record,
yeah,
how do you really keep track?
Right, right.
And, you know, the fact that we all have handheld cameras now, cell phones and whatnot, yeah.
Not the same.
It's not nearly the same. There's not, no. There, again, you don't have the great photographers who really concentrated on lighting and angles.
Yeah.
Really took the aspect of photography and made it art.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
The artistic aspect of it is gone.
Yeah.
And like you said, these guys now are more concerned about how big they are and whatnot, how full and round the muscle looks. And it's more cartoonish than it is the art of bodybuilding.
Yeah.
And I'm not one to poo-poo everybody's work, because everybody's body of work warrants the respect and credibility that is due.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they don't have the backing of the photographers, the documentation of the magazines, because it happens and it's gone.
It's gone, yeah, yeah. Let me talk to you about your training, LQ, because now it seems like when I watch all these videos on social media, everybody's training super heavy. I don't know how they're getting so strong, but they're just training more and more heavier. What was your training like when you were competing?
I mean, there was always heavy training, because that goes back to the old adage, if you want to get big, you got to move big weight.
Right, right.
But my training was a combination of heavy training and conditioning, which was higher reps, making the muscle burn and supersetting. I was never really into giant sets, because that was a trend back then. I got into giant sets because I was more interested in actually fine tuning the muscle and targeting specific muscle groups, as opposed to going from exercise to exercise to exercise. You just end up wearing yourself out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my trainer, one of my other trainers, we came up with a technique where we would do two sets of 15, but the two sets of 15 would be at 80 to 85%. Max of your ability to, you know, lift at the top of the scale, 85% of your max weight.
Wow.
And if you can do two sets of 15 like that, it's a different type of workout.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all about saving glycogen.
Mm-hmm.
Started getting scientific and technical, because we want to really burn the muscle and work and etch in the detail, but we also want to save the glycogen so that you maintain the fullness, because again, my particular build, because I have long limbs. I mean, I'm like 5'9", 9.5", 5'10". But I have the wingspan of a 6-footer.
Yeah.
I've got long arms and long legs, and you know, I can stand beside somebody who's 6'3" and I can jump with them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, athletically, I can hang with him because of, again, just to reach. It's like a basketball player back in the day. I don't know if you remember Allen Iverson.
Yeah, sure.
Philadelphia 76ers.
Philadelphia, yeah.
He was like a 6-footer, but his wingspan was incredible. I mean, he was very rangy. With that, you know, anytime you're a long and rangy person, you have to take that into account. You're only going to get so big. You're only going to put so much muscle on that frame. So you have to learn how to train for that. Mm-hmm. And that's what that was one of the techniques that we came up with, two sets of 15 at 85%.
Okay.
And also,
like at the end of your, that'd be like the last two sets. Like go heavier, 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 and then do the two sets of 15.
Actually, no. I mean, we would do a series of exercises, like two sets of 15 for like five movements. So that's 10 sets.
Okay. Okay.
The body part.
Gotcha. Okay.
And everybody's like, that's kind of strange. That's some of the two sets of 15. You're only doing two sets? Like, that's kind of easy. I said, now bump up to 85% of your max.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start like, whoa.
Right.
It sounds easy, but it's not.
No.
You know, you start thinking, you know, every set is 15 reps. After a while, that gets long.
Yeah.
And the thing was to, you know, again, as we used to say, hit it and quit it, get in, get out.
Yeah.
You know, the object for me was to, you know, keep eating so I could, you know, maintain the size and get the
fullness. Yeah.
Get the fullness and keep the fuel in the muscle and keep the body fueled.
Right. Okay.
I got to the point where I was eating, this sounds crazy, I was eating Klondike bars before and intra training because we were using it for not just the sugar, but the fat.
Okay.
Just to keep fat, a constant induction of fat into the system.
Yeah.
And as weird as that sounds, it worked.
Yeah.
You know, it's like ice cream, get out of here. No, you're not supposed to do that. And that's, you know, the opposite. Yeah, but these are the tricks of the trade because again, you're dealing with a quote unquote race car, not a street car.
Yeah.
And the stuff that they do in auto racing is dramatically different than what they might do at Tires Plus or wherever you take your car, you know.
Right.
Like, what's happening on the racetrack is like, no.
Yeah. Now, I'll get back to some of your contests here. So your first year as a pro was 92. You got third in that Ironman, which was really good. And then you got sixth in the Pittsburgh Pro.
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting when I was looking at this was you got 13th in the Olympia. But then after that, they had all those Grand Prix in Europe. And you did really good, and like in Holland and Italy, you got second. So you beat a lot of the guys that you beat at the Olympia,
right? Because at that point, it becomes a game of attrition, and it's interesting to watch people as time goes on, and when you've got them in a crucible, when you're really putting everybody to the test, that European show, European tour. Was grueling.
Yeah, I heard.
You're going from not just city to city, you're going from country to country.
Right. And
climate changes, food changes.
Yeah.
Environment, everything is different at every show. So you're in a constant state of adjustment. You have to improvise, adjust, and adapt on the fly.
Right.
After a period of time, guys just get tired, they get frustrated. People get to the point where they just want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever stays dialed in and whoever stays focused the longest, the best, those are the people who you see, you know, rise.
Yeah. Did your condition get better after the Olympia on the tour?
My conditioning got better. Plus, I was hanging out with a chef.
Oh, really?
In Holland. And he was basically telling me how to eat.
Oh, no kidding. What did he tell you?
He was basically, you know, telling me about the carbs. Telling me about protein ratios and how to keep everything to keep your look, keep yourself tight. And he said, never overeat. Never overeat. When you get to the point you are full, push away.
Yeah.
If you have to leave food on the plate, he said, that's not a good look. It's not desirable. But if you're full, that's it.
Yeah. Was he giving you advice for when you go to restaurants because you're eating at restaurants all the time?
Restaurants as well as just overall.
Okay.
All right. You know, he would tell me, you know, this guy was a gastronomic wizard.
Oh, that's great.
He was a master of five cuisines and desserts. And he basically was telling me which, you know, proteins work best, which proteins are quickly assimilated into the body, which carbohydrates stay away from, push away from the table, even if you are, you know, you want to eat more. If you're full, you're full, because the stomach, you know, you don't want your stomach to distend.
Hmm.
You want everything to stay tight.
Right.
Hmm. He was telling me about the interior lining of, you know, the interior muscle.
Yeah.
If you start to stretch this out, it's not going to come back, regardless of how many abs, you know, ab work you do, blah, 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 blah.
Wow.
Wow. So I would really sit down and talk with this guy. And, you know, most people thought I was just hanging out and, you know, chilling and we were just rapping. No, he was breaking a lot of stuff down.
Wow, that's cool. And, did you feel you should have did better than 13th at that Olympia, your first Olympia?
Do you have the
I got the list here.
Placings? Give me the top 10 placings and I'll tell you.
Dorian was first.
Okay.
This was the one in Helsinki, right?
Helsinki.
Yeah. Kevin was second, Lee Labrada third, Sean was fourth, Ben Aziza was fifth, Vince Taylor sixth, Sonny Schmidt was seventh, Porter Cottrell eighth, Ron Love ninth, Thierry Pastel 10th, and then Steve Brisbois was 11th, Ferrigno was 12th, and you were 13th.
I could have been in the top 10.
Okay. Yeah, I know it's a lot of those guys you beat on the Grand Prix Tour, Thierry Pastel, Ron Love, Porter Cottrell.
And the other thing, too, and this is, again, I'm not going to, you know, take swings at individuals because this is a long time ago. But I got sick at the Olympia because I had some bad chicken.
Mm.
So by the time I got to the show, I had smoothed out.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't tight as I had been prior to a couple of meals.
Okay.
And had some bad chicken. And I spent the day or so prior to the Olympia, the show itself, I spent it in bed. Mm. I was curled up in a ball because I was sick.
Yeah. Wow.
And by the time I got to the show, I had smoothed out and it took me literally to, I think by the time we got to Spain, I had gotten back on track.
Okay. Okay. That's why your placings went up so much.
Yeah. That's why I went back up. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then you did the Arnold Classic in 93. That was the debut of Flex Wheeler. That was when he came, his first year as a pro.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think of Flex and the new guy, Paul Dillette? What'd you think of those guys?
I heard about Paul in 91 and 92. So you can wait till you see this guy. Wait till you see this guy. And yeah. I'm like, okay. And then I met him at, I believe, the Ironman in 92. I'm like, wow, this dude is huge. Not only is he tall, but he's really big.
Yeah.
Flex, I always had a good relationship and interaction with Flex, and I watched Flex grow and mature and become the bodybuilder that he did, even when he played second to Ronnie. Mm-hmm. Flex has always had that genetic freakiness, the small wasp waist,
yeah,
the corn cob abs, very rounded muscle,
yeah,
very well grouped. And he just got to the point where he became freakishly cartoonish in a quality way.
Yeah, right.
Again, he had one of the best physiques of all time. If people were calling him the uncrowned Mr. Olympia. Mm-hmm. I mean, he definitely had an Olympia caliber physique. I mean, one of the best of all time. When you put his physique in any era.
Yeah.
It stands out on its own.
Right, right. I agree.
You can put him beside any of the aesthetic guys, any of the mass guys, and his physique stands out. Now, you can argue, okay, he had narrow clavicles, and okay, you know, his calves could have been this, and now you're starting to split hairs, and you're really mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You can do that with all of us.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was impressed with Flex. Again, at that point, 92, 93, I'm still trying to close the gap.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys have a lot more seasoning and a lot more experience show-wise than I do.
Yeah.
Even though I was looking at them, my whole mindset was to close the gap and get fuller, get bigger, get rounder, get to the point where I can stand next to these guys. And that didn't happen until like 4 years later, 96, 97.
Okay.
Then 97 is when I got injured.
What happened with your injury?
I had a freak slip and fall.
Oh, no.
For all intents and purposes, it's the Wells Fargo Center now in Philadelphia where the 76ers play. I went to a basketball game, went to a Sixers game.
Yeah.
And leaving the arena, I had a freak slip and fall.
Hmm.
And it snapped both my patella tendons.
Both of them?
Both of them at the same time.
Man. Damn.
So that, for all intents and purposes, ended the career.
Mm. Wow.
The surgeons were able to reattach everything, and I am able to do everything I did prior to the injury. They repaired me to pre-injury status.
Yeah.
They told me, you know, hey, if you tear this again, it's game over.
Mm. Wow.
It came down to competing, walking.
Yeah, right.
Walking one.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Wow.
I got myself, I rehabbed myself, and I got myself back on stage the following year, but the damage was already done, and the quadriceps were never really able to return to pre-injury status, the shape mm-hmm. and the volume, the size. So at that point, I had to respectfully, you know.
Yeah. Did the quads look different, or was it just the training, you know, with the size and stuff?
The quads look different because, again, with a surgeon, the quads were surgically reattached. And at the time, 1997, it was state-of-the-art technology how they did it.
Yeah.
Drilled a hole through the kneecap and using basically, for all intents and purposes, fishing line and a baseball stitch, and then they reattached the quad to the patella. No pins, no titanium, nothing like that. It's all polypropylene.
Mm.
It's pretty remarkable, fantastic stuff. Because to this day, knock on wood, everything is still intact.
Okay.
And no problem. I can do pretty much whatever I want to do. And I can train pretty much, I'll just say, 70-80% of what I did.
Yeah.
When competing. It's not necessary to train that heavy now. I would never.
Yeah.
But I do things now just for conditioning and to keep myself in shape and to be able to do whatever I want to do on demand.
Yeah. Yeah.
To train like a bodybuilder. I still have a bodybuilder's regimen with my training,
mm-hmm.
but not nearly the intensity or anything like that. It's not necessary.
Yeah. But you still train regularly and stuff just because you enjoy it.
I still train 4 days a week.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay. Cool.
Mm-hmm. I get in the gym and I always laugh when people say, they look at me now, like, wow, you look great. Are you getting ready for a show? I'm like, you don't know me. It's like,
right. No, they don't know.
There's a whole new generation of kids out there who have no clue.
Yeah.
I don't tell them. If they know, they know. But right. I don't tell them. And they're like, wow, you look, I said, if you think this is good, you should have seen me. 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Right. Well, you look great, man. You look in great shape. You don't look your age at all. I mean, you look really, really young.
59.
I'm right behind you. I know what you mean.
Yeah, I was like, wow. I was talking to one of my childhood friends. I've known him. I'm 59. I've known him for 54 years.
Mm-hmm.
We were saying something the other day. It's like, talking about somebody, and they were like 61. It's like, yeah, they're kind of old. And then we both started laughing. And I'm like, damn, we're right there.
Right. I know.
Like, we're like, wow. I'd say it's hard to believe.
And it goes by so fast, too, doesn't it?
It has gone by. I mean, I will never think of myself, nor do I feel old.
Yeah.
And it's all a state of mind. What they say is a state of mind is true.
Right, right.
Believe that. You are what you think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And
as a man thinketh, so is he.
Yeah.
So you really have to be careful about the way you project your mindset, your thoughts, and what you voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
You literally speak it into existence.
Yeah, that's true. I interviewed John DiCola. He was the 1969 Mr. America couple weeks ago, and he's 83. He said he never thinks about his age. He still acts young. You know, he just never. He's still training. He looks great.
There's a guy in one of the gyms down here. He is 88 now.
Wow.
He's a former United States Air Force major, because every time he comes in the gym, I salute him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's 88. This guy is literally 12 ticks off 100.
Yeah.
He comes in and hits the machines, works out.
Damn.
And he's mobile. His handshake is strong.
Yeah.
One day he saw us when we came in the gym and we were doing push-ups. He said, What you guys doing? So we did push-ups. He said, how many? He said, sets of 25. He literally came in cold.
No way.
25 reps with no problem.
Wow. That's awesome.
I had to shake his hand. I gave him a hug. I'm like, yo, man. I said, that's damn impressive.
That is.
I want to be like you when I get to where, if I'm fortunate enough to get to where you are.
Right, right, right.
And at the time, I mean, wow. That's 31 years. He's got me by 88, 89. This is 5 years ago. He's 91 now.
Oh, is he? No shit.
But he did that when he was 88.
Wow.
That's just impressive.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah, that's the benefit of bodybuilding, you know, if you do it right.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. I mean, you got to, you know, eat right, keep yourself fit. The body's a machine.
Yeah.
You got to take care of it. You take care of it, it'll take care of you.
Yeah. Yeah, do you think you got out of the sport at the right time, especially seeing where it was going with the emphasis on size? And
absolutely.
Yeah.
I, you know, could I compete in this era? Probably, you know, if I took off 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I would not want to, because I don't like the direction that it's taken. I mean, again, all due respect to all the competitors and what they're doing and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I come from a different era. So I have that to measure it by.
Mm-hmm.
And I admire the era that I came from. I admire all the guys who were in my era, who I competed against. I like the guys now. I mean, all respect and all power to them.
Yeah.
But I really just admire the guys from my era and even prior to, like, the late 80s and the 70s. It's like,
me too,
when you look at those cats, they did not have the advent of the technology, all the information that you have now.
Right.
And they were still able to create these physiques and the looks.
Yeah.
That were the foundation of everything that is today.
Right, right, exactly. So when you look back at over your career, LQ, is there any shows that really stand out? We talked about the Nationals, of course, and some of your first pro shows, but throughout your other pro career, was there any other shows that were really memorable for you?
The shows that stand out are when I did the Night of Champions, it was Mike Francois, John Sherman.
And, Mike Quinn was in that.
Mike Quinn was in it. We got into a little elbow battle on stage. Everybody loved John Sherman and Nasser El Sombadi. That was great. The two shows in the European Grand Prix with Italy and Spain. Italy and Holland.
Holland, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that show, that's when Momo Benaziza died.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But I came in second in that show. But the whole European Grand Prix tour that year was great.
Okay.
Got a chance to really hang out and know the guys, Sonny Schmitz, the Henderson Thorns.
Yeah.
You know, the Cottrells, Vince Taylor when he was on the tour, because he started and he left early. Got a chance to really meet and know Lee Labrada at that tour. Ron Love. Ron Love was one of the first guys who I met when I turned pro. Mm-hmm. he was one of the first guys who really extended his hand and said, yo, man, welcome to the pros. And,
oh, that's cool. Yeah.
This is like, he said, you're part of the crew now. So,
you
know, do your thing. I will always remember that we were walking down the street in New York. This is prior to the Night of Champions. And just being able to hang out with the guys and that kind of camaraderie and just having that interaction, like a team. Even though we're all individuals and we're all competing, you know, for ourselves, it was like a team. It was being part of that fraternity, that clique.
Right.
And that was always cool.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Any other guys that you met that were really cool or that stood out on stage, maybe?
Steve Brisbois was always cool. Good conversationalist. I got to know him on a flight going over to Helsinki.
Okay.
Henderson Thorne. Of course, there was Vince. I mean, Vince and I were on a couple of tours over in Europe, and we had dinner a few times and talked. The FIBO over in Germany got to meet and know a lot of people. Juliet Bergman.
Yeah.
Dorian, Lou.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the names just keep going. Hans Langer. Remember her? All these people who you, again, it's kind of funny, who you've seen in the magazines, I had a chance to, you know, actually meet and converse with them and hang out and talk. And, you know, we would have either lunch or dinner and, you know, you get a chance to really sit down and talk with people. And then you get to know them outside of the persona that was projected in the magazines back then.
Yeah, that's cool.
That was always cool. I always enjoyed that and being on tour, not necessarily the competition tours, but the exhibition tours.
Okay. Yeah.
The promoters would bring you over and you would do training expos and exhibitions in various gyms and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And this is when it was really cool to be over in Europe. And, you know, Italy, Holland, Germany. Wow. I mean, England, France. I mean, I pretty much did the whole circuit. Czechoslovakia, when it was Czechoslovakia.
Right. Right.
Hungary, Budapest. I mean, Spain. I mean, it's when I look back on it, it was a great, great career. It was cool. Even though it got preempted by the injury, the time that I was out there from 1990 to 97, I had a blast, and I retired. I retired for sure in 2000.
Okay.
So it's been 21 years.
Wow. Yeah. You grew up. You were in a great era. You know, you competed in a great era. Yeah.
Well, one of the greatest, most competitive eras.
Absolutely.
In I mean, so they were 8, 9, 10, 11 guys deep when you came to those, and you had to be on. And everybody, it's funny. People used to come up to each other, they would look at you and they would just go, you're in shape. Or you're like, you're holding a little too much water, man. And they would pull up the shape, like, you know.
Right.
All that kind of stuff. It was cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was before the guys got super, super big, but the conditioning was still on and it was really.
Conditioning was king.
Yeah, yeah.
Conditioning was king. I mean, we used to really get critical. It's like, yo, man, you're not dry enough.
Right.
And, you know, you would look at, you know, you'd tell somebody, you pull up the back. Remember I said how you look from the front, but turn them around.
Right.
Pull up the T-shirt and just look at them like.
Yeah.
You look okay. You're good. You're on.
Yeah.
Right. Guys would come to your room in the hotel just to see how you were doing.
Yeah.
Remember, Chris Comier and Paul Dillette came to my room at one of the shows. And say, okay, Q, I see you're on. You're good, good. Flex the quad, man. And, you know, they say, oh, yeah, he's separated. He's good.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
That's awesome. All right, LQ. Well, thank you very much for the conversation. Thank you for joining me on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely, John. I appreciate you.
All right, buddy.
All right.
I'll talk to you soon. It was great meeting you.
Absolutely. You as well. Take care, man.
All right, buddy.
All right.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you so much also to all our Patreon donors who are generously donating money to the podcast each month. You guys really help us keep going. If anyone out there is interested in becoming a sponsor on Patreon, you can do that just by going to the bodybuildinglegendshow.com website. And you'll see the Patreon link in the upper right-hand corner. All right, before I let you guys go, I do want to read a couple articles from some old Ironman magazines. The first one is from the November 1981 issue of Ironman. It's got a great shot of Mike Mentzer from the 1980 Olympia from Vince Basile. And the article says, Belknap wins Mr. America. And this is, of course, from the 1981 Mr. America. Dave Sawyer was the author of the article. It says, Tim Belknap, 22 years old. Wow, I forgot Tim was only 22. From Rockford, Illinois, is the 1981 Mr. America. Belknap, competing in the light heavyweight class, defeated pre-contest favorites Roy Liedemeyer and Bronson Austin, and then went on to win the overall title with a 4-3 split decision over heavyweight Lance Dreher. Staged before a sellout crowd at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas, the 1981 Mr. America contest was the largest ever held, with exactly 100 athletes competing for amateur bodybuilding's top title. Producer-director Nick Martino did a very professional job of running the show, which was videotaped for HBO. Gone were the television lights and poor viewing conditions, which had ruined last year's contest in Santa Monica. The only serious problem to plague this year's show was the limited seating capacity, only 1,300, of the Circus Maximus showroom. A larger venue could have accommodated the overflow crowd, which had to watch the show in another room on closed-circuit TV. If winning a national contest is partly a matter of luck, it was never more evident than in Las Vegas. Rory Liedemeyer, who had looked so good when he won the Mr. California title last year, was tail smooth and appeared to be suffering from muscle spasms, maybe a mineral imbalance, as he went through his outstanding posing routine. Bronson Austin, who won the light heavyweight class last year and was runner-up to Gary Leonard, ended up in fourth place behind Liedemeyer and Billy Arlen. Arlen was in top shape, and many thought he should have actually placed higher than third. Actually, the judging was very close among the top men, with only 1 or 2 points separating the winners. Although the light heavyweight class was the most difficult to judge, there was plenty of action in the other weight classes. In the lightweight class, Ken Passarello repeated his first-place finish from last year after a strong challenge from newcomers Cliff Coons, Jose Guzman, and Steve Davis. Dean Tornabene and Paul Daniels were also impressive. Joe Destini, who was third a year ago, finished a disappointing ninth. The lightweight class has experienced a dramatic improvement in numbers of quality physiques since weight classes replaced the old height groups a few years ago and can no longer be considered a weak weight class. With Richard Baldwin out of the competition, a free-for-all developed in the middleweight class. James Youngblood emerged the winner over Ellis Evans, Charles Colson, Bill Register, and former Mr. USA Pat Nevey. Last year's trophy winners Bill Register, Casey Schneider, and Mike Torchia all lost ground in the standings, victims of the unprecedented level of quality seen throughout the 1981 Mr. America contest. Lance Dreher, who was third in the heavyweight class last year, moved up to win the top spot by narrowly defeating Bob Reese and Don Asmus. 1980 finalist Greg DeFerro and John Kemper did not compete. 19-year-old Mike Quinn, the current teenage Mr. America, made a very good showing by placing in the top 10 in this very competitive class. Quinn should do well in future national contests as he continues to improve his already outstanding physique. Judging the 1981 Mr. America contest were three panels, each comprised of 7 national card holders. The first panel judged the lightweight and light heavyweight classes. A second panel scored middleweights and heavyweights. And a third group judged the final pose down at the Mr. America show. Clarence Bass, Terry Brooks, Jim Smith, and Vicky Smith all voted for Tim Belknap. And then John Meese, Rod Miller, and Charles Simkovich voted for Lance. So that was a 4-3 decision. So that was it. Let me read these classes. Heavyweight class was Lance in first, Bob Reese second, Don Asmus third, Bob Coburn fourth, Jerry McCall fifth, Marlon Darton, who we just talked about, was sixth. Ron McBeth was seventh. Jeff Everson, Corey Everson's husband, was in eighth place. Daniel Franklin ninth, and Michael Quinn was in 10th as a teenager. Unbelievable. Light heavyweight class was won by Tim Belknap, of course. Rory Liedemeyer was second. Billy Arlen third. Bronson Austin fourth after winning the class last year. Charles Glass, who usually competed as a middleweight, was in the light heavy and took fifth. Ernie Santiago, who won the Mr. USA, I believe the year before, was in sixth place. Jesse Goutreau was in seventh. Alan Katoa was eighth. Paul Love, who was ninth. Paul was a great promoter. He promoted the 1983 Nationals. And Raymond Jingo was 10th. The middleweights, Jim Youngblood was first, Ellis Evans second, Charles Colson third, Bill Register fourth, Pat Neavy fifth, James Goubert was in sixth, Bob Jockowitz seventh, Tony Pandolfo was in eighth, Casey Schneider ninth, and Greg Silha was in 10th. And then finally, the lightweight class, Ken Passarello first, Cliff Coons second, Jose Guzman third, Steve Davis fourth, Dean Tornabene in fifth, Paul Daniels sixth, Larry Emanuel in seventh, Don Anderson in eighth, Joe Giustini in ninth, and Dan Carpenter in 10th. All right. And then I've got another article to read here. This is from the March 1982 issue of Iron Man. And this says, How I Saw the Mr. Olympia and the Top Six Men. And this is written by Stephen Robinson. Our duty is to believe that for that which we have sufficient evidence and to suspend our judgment when we have not. John Lubbock, 1803 to 1865. Give your decisions, never your reasons. Your decisions may be right. Your reasons are sure to be wrong. Earl of Mansfield, 1705 to 1793. Even 200 years ago, people had trouble judging, yet here we are today still with the same problem. I was not of the caliber to stand among them, so who am I to say where they should stand? I would like to keep this article brief and to the point, trying to deal with just the top six men and let Gary Bartlett go into detail. When I took my seat in the pit of the prejudging, I never thought it would take so long to see the 17 greatest physiques in the world. When I define greatest physiques, the words good sportsmanship and a forgiving nature are always in the back of my mind. Prejudging for the Mr. International lasted at least 4 hours. I could not believe how the audience came alive after that prejudging for the Mr. Olympia. Well, here are my judgments. At the prejudging, Franco looked out of this world. He stood next to Roy Callender in the lineup, who kept prompting a pose off. When Franco finally replied, they were both reprimanded by Oscar State. At the prejudging, Franco had clear advantages. He was positioned in the middle, so the judges could always see him. This was used well. I must admit, Franco to me looked like the best from my perch less than 20 feet away. He had something the others lacked, one of the attributes you can never put your finger on. Although his legs were not up to par, they looked good. His upper body was fantastic. At the night show, I decided to take a new vantage point among the people who really support the show. I went to the back of the house. From there, Franco took on a whole new light. The fine detail I noticed from 20 feet diminished. In my prejudge prediction, I had him in first place at the night show. I moved him to second. Backstage, when I again saw him pose up close, he was moved back into first place. All in all, Franco had a fight and he won. I know this Olympia will be criticized as much as last year's. Let's hope it does not hurt the sport too much. Chris Dickerson placed second. I follow Chris since his comeback 3 years ago. I was in the same pit when he placed sixth in the Mr. Olympia. I've seen Chris in almost all the Grand Prix shows, and I've seen him in the best shape of his life. With Chris, I make my judgment on his past physique. Today, he was nowhere near his top shape. In my prejudge prediction, I didn't even have Chris in the top six. Standing in the lineup, it looked to me like he lacked his own aura of confidence. His stance, usually proud and of a winner, was awkward looking. But don't count this man out yet. He'll be a big winner again this coming year. Tom Platz, the new uncrowned Mr. Olympia. When I first saw this man in the basement selling his shirts and routines, he was mobbed by fans. Even through a sweatsuit, they could see a winner. At the prejudge, I had Tom in second place. At the night show, I really thought he'd won it. Tom was not only the audience favorite, but also the press favorite. So what happened to the judges? Tom took his defeat with all the dignity of a champion. Tom, you're the press, Mr. Olympia. Roy Callender was the only prediction I made right. He was the best shape of his life, but he seemed to lack something. Something I can't put my finger on, but I'm sure Roy will someday be able to take this top title. Danny Padilla, my third place prediction, shot down a fifth place finish. I've never seen Danny look like this before. John Bailey described his attitude on stage by saying he could eat sharks. I'll bet he could have too. Many giants were killed in Columbus on that stage. Danny posed to Exodus. I thought he would have done much better to his short people. All he needs is to improve his pose off routine a little bit. Danny was also a press favorite. Don't give up yet. Joseph Wilkosch was out of his league. He has a strong-looking physique, but it does not stand up to the Olympias yet. But give him time. He'll prove me wrong. Well, there you have it. I tried to keep it brief. I'd like to apologize ahead of time for my rough criticism of the bodybuilders, but I'm only human and I make mistakes just like the judges do. In closing, I'd like to give my own awards. Most improved goes to Mike Katz. Also most understanding. When asked what he thought of the contest, he had this to say. When Arnold was winning, no one complained because he was so much better than everyone. But now the men are very close. No matter who wins, someone will complain. Most muscle per square inch, Johnny Fuller. I had Johnny in the top six, but believe it or not, he wants to add about 20 more pounds of muscle. Most forgiving, Chris Dickerson and Dennis Tenorino for giving up the boycott. Thank you. All right. That was a short article. But definitely a different viewpoint of the 81 Olympia, where this author thinks that Franco should have won. Most people didn't feel that way. All right. That's all I got for the show this week, guys. Hope you enjoyed it. Come back next week to hear part one of our interview with the great giant killer, Danny Padilla. Stay healthy. Enjoy your workouts. And we'll see you guys next week. Take care.